There are 10:15, having arrived, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order. We do not have a quorum quite yet. As soon as we will break in and do a few administrative things here as soon as we do have a quorum. But we're very fortunate here to have Chairman O'Driscoll with us today. I will move House File 260. I do not see, when we have a quorum, I do not see any amendments. So, Chairman O'Driscoll, to your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Tax Committee. This is a bill that I had introduced last biennium, and I think it's a bill that continues to incentivize Minnesotans with the desire to purchase long-term care. Anybody who's familiar with St. Paul, either inside or outside of the Dome of the Capitol, knows that there is a health insurance crisis that's ensuing here in the state of Minnesota and across the country. The next one is going to be a long-term care for people, particularly with baby boomers as they age. And my proposal, Mr. Chair, takes current state statute for individuals and moves the tax credit on your Minnesota tax return from $100 or 25% of premiums to $200 per tax year, and for married persons from $200 to $400. If you buy long-term care insurance at a younger age where it's more affordable and you get the tax credit, you are being able to prepare for the future that you want, and the state of Minnesota taxpayers will certainly receive a benefit from individuals who are looking to prepare for their future as well. So with that, Mr. Chair, those are my opening comments. I'm happy to take questions or to visit with others on the matter.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll, and we have heard this concept previously, but we are a new legislature for this year, so we're going to take another run at it here. So, with that being said, before we go to member questions, is there anyone from the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of the bill with concerns thereof? And Mr. Cummings, you can join us. I think we'll go to a few member questions first, so Mr. Cummings. Questions from members on House File 260. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the average cost for long-term care insurance for a 50-year-old?
Chairman O'Driscoll.
Well, I'm not currently selling long-term care insurance in the marketplace, but I'm going to estimate, and the chair probably knows better because he's in the insurance industry. I'm going to guess that the cost for long-term care insurance for somebody who's maybe in their 50s at this point would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $250 to $300 a month per person. Again, it depends upon the level of service you buy, with the elimination periods of 30, 60, or 90 days, which is a time deductible on that, and the benefits you buy per day is at $100, $150, $250, $300. There's a lot of variables that go in, so I'm just giving you a number. That would probably be, from the last time I looked at the numbers, probably about a 60-day elimination period with about $150 a day benefit, $250 roughly, depending, again, upon the carrier.
Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what percentage of Minnesotans currently have their own long-term care insurance policy?
I can't give you the numbers on the number of Minnesotans who currently have long-term care insurance. I can tell you that for the Department of Revenue's number, they say that 62,000 tax returns take advantage of the current deductible or current tax credit. And so 62,000 people are being affected some way, shape, or form, because it could be an individual or a married couple that is receiving the benefit on that. It's about $137 per return benefit that, again, using the Minnesota Department of Revenue's numbers on that, that folks are receiving.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you know the income levels of those 62,000? I mean, are they well above the poverty line? Are they wealthier individuals?
Chair O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, that information is confidential information. That's not information that's being released by the Department of Revenue, as is anyone's income that's not released. So whether they have the ability to or have undertaken any kind of a study on that, I don't have that information. Maybe Mr. Cummings can speak to that question for Representative Schultz.
Representative Schultz?
Mr. Cummings, do you have that information?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, we do not.
Thank you.
Okay, and that was Mr. Cummings from the department. Okay, and to that question, it's a very interesting question Representative Schultz asked, and I think you described it perfectly, Chair O'Driscoll, that it's all over the place, because you could have a $100 a day benefit to a $200 a day benefit. Do you put an inflator on? Do you not put an inflator on? Is it a 30-day wait, a 60-day wait, a 90-day wait, 180, or a 365-day wait?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could add on to that, you also have to have an inflator in there or not, and some of those kinds of things are guaranteed benefits. If you stop the policy, do you get a certain level of benefit going forward because you prepaid some of those benefits? And so there's just different kinds of things that are available in that.
Correct.
Chair Carlson.
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, my questions were somewhat similar to at least the initial questions that were asked by Representative Schultz. But, you know, there was a lot of excitement when we made this available a few years ago, and then there was a fair amount of disappointment due to the low participation rate. And my question was similar in terms of the participation rate, but a follow-up to that, are those numbers fairly constant, or is there a growth in the number of people that are purchasing the insurance, being that it was disappointing, at least initially, a few years ago?
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson. I don't have specifics on that. Again, I'm going to defer to the Department of Revenue since they have a benchmark on that. I can tell you that currently they're telling us that there's about 62,000 returns that benefit from this. My initial reaction would be that as premiums go up on this and the benefit stays the same, people may choose not to or drop the coverage, which means that they don't take advantage of the tax credit. And as a result of that, they're, if you will, kind of on their own, which if they run out of assets, then they become asking for public assistance and public support on that. So if we keep more people on, the better we are.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I understand the concept, and like several of us was probably here when we moved in that direction. And my question, I saw in the fiscal note that there are 62,000, but my question was, is that sort of a constant number these days, or are more people buying the insurance, or was it at one time higher and it's dropped down to 62,000, and maybe others that monitor this would have that information? But thank you.
Let's, since we have the two here, we'll keep two before we go to member questions. Chair Carlson, you're still on the list, because let's hear from the department.
Okay.
Let's hear from the department.
Yes.
We have a quorum. Okay, I'll officially call the House Tax Committee meeting to order as we have a quorum. I will, Representative Schultz, thank you so much for moving the minutes of January 24th, 2017. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I will move House File 260, and we won't be voting on this. I do want to let the committee know that we do have kind of an interesting situation here on House File 244, so when we get to that we are going to take a vote on that, and Chair Mark Ford's office has been contacted on that, and we'll hear why when we get to that bill. So just that one we will be taking a vote on to the General Register, but we are on House File 260 as I have moved it. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager of the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
I did reach out to Representative O'Driscoll's office, and confirming right before the hearing, it looks like I was unsuccessful. But we were able to speak briefly here. I will also say that Representative O'Driscoll has been quoting detailed portions of the revenue estimate in the bill, and he's doing this freeform. So it's pretty impressive to sort of have all the detailed elements that are coming out. But anyway.
Mr. Chair, I learned that from Chief Justice Roberts.
Good point. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, this bill would increase the credit rate to 50% of eligible premiums and increase the maximum credit from $100 to $200 per beneficiary. The maximum total credit would be $400 for married joint filers and $200 for all other filers. Many have suggested that the reason to expand the long-term care credit was to incent more people to buy long-term care insurance and to reduce public spending on social services and Medicare. A tax expenditure is a costlier and less efficient way to solve a social problem. We have many resources to draw from to learn about the credit and impact. The tax expenditure budget put out by the Department's Tax Research Division references the credit, and House Research has done some analysis and summaries of selected tax credits as well. In all the studies that we have reviewed, the cost of the deductions or credits in reduced federal or state tax revenues exceed the savings realized in state and federal spending and Medicaid programs. Looking at some studies helps us better understand the issue. Ann Tyson Kramer and Gail Jensen, in their study entitled Why Don't People Buy Long-Term Care Insurance, found that price was a small but significant factor in the decision to purchase long-term care insurance. A credit would, in effect, reduce the price of insurance.
but the inelastic nature of both price and potential price increases suggests that in the current environment, initiatives that rely on lowering price are likely to meet with limited success. A 25% discount in price, for example, a credit like Minnesota's, but without a maximum dollar limit, would increase purchases of insurance by about 0.5%. David Nixon, in his study entitled State Programs to Encourage Long-Term Care Insurance, found no statistically significant relationship between the availability of state tax incentives and the purchases of long-term care insurance. Charles Kortmanch and Dai-Fung He, in their study entitled Tax Incentives and the Decision to Purchase Long-Term Care Insurance, found that the federal itemized deduction for long-term care insurance increased the take-up rate of long-term care insurance for eligible individuals by 3.3 percentage points. But the net effect was to reduce revenue by $187 and to reduce Medicaid spending by about $91. Thus, for every dollar of tax expenditures, 49 cents of Medicaid savings were realized. Tax credits are often inefficient. Many people want money in their hands right away. Tax credits are paid after taxes are filed. When the taxes are finally calculated, taxpayers will not receive a long-term care credit check. Instead, they will receive a larger total refund check or a smaller amount they owe to the state. Except for the box that you checked on your tax filing software, there's little connection between the credit and the behavior. If this bill moves through the process, Mr. Chair, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Representative O'Driscoll, and staff. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource.
So I can see the department's kind of warming up to the idea.
We're here to help.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
We appreciate that. Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to appreciate Mr. Cummings' comments and thoughts on here. In another part of the life that I have here in the legislature, I'm the chair of the Pension Commission. One of the things that we learned in the Pension Commission is that folks aren't saving for retirement. So literally everything that Mr. Cummings is talking about are some of the reasons why people aren't saving for retirement. They maybe don't have the money. There aren't the right incentives that are there. But when you ask people, why aren't you saving for retirement, they say, well, I don't necessarily have the money. And then the follow-up answer a lot of times is, I like to work. Well, I just keep working and I will enjoy working in my retirement. Well, there comes a point in time where you don't want to work anymore and you don't have those resources. So the same types of things that we're looking at from a long-term care perspective is the same things that we're looking at for people who aren't able to prepare or properly prepare for their retirement. Those folks are going to be coming to the state or the federal government looking for relief to meet basic needs. I'm just asking us to try to avoid another crisis on the horizon or minimize that. Baby boomers are starting to retire. Baby boomers are the people who really should be purchasing this coverage right now when it's still affordable. And we were also seeing through the Pension Commission that the longevity of people, life expectancy, has bumped out where males are living to be around 81 to 82 years of age and women are living to about 83 to 84 years of age, meaning that they will most likely be needing some type of long-term care benefit. Again, we can say that incentives don't work. I'm putting this forward today so we can start this conversation as a state to figure out how we can help individuals to be able to prepare for an inevitable event that's going to happen. I'm all for people living longer, healthier, and happier. People to have long-term care is going to be increasing. I want to make one more statement, Mr. Chair, about long-term care. The way you can purchase long-term care doesn't mean you have to be in a skilled nursing facility to take advantage of it. It means it makes money available for people to stay in their own home, have people come in, the comfort of that individual's home to receive services periodically, and that certainly preserves the dignity and the integrity of the process.
On the newer contracts, on some of the older, it's just nursing home only, some then branched out to skilled care. Okay, so you mentioned, Chair O'Driscoll, while it's still affordable, it's a good idea, but while you're still insurable, because it's a very tough contract to get from the underwriting standpoint, so you do need to be quite healthy to get it in the first place. But you make some very good points, and I see where both of you are coming from. As far as just the numbers go, yeah, the department has a case that, well, you know, you put this money in, you're not getting that big of a bang for the buck. But this is something we are going to have to look at very, very closely, because every long-term care policy that somebody purchases, especially if it's one of the qualified plans, is going to lessen the burden on the state and the county down the road, because they're going to have their long-term care covered by their policy rather than spending down and going on the county, if you will. So this is something I think we do need to encourage. I've been, you know, doing this since 1982, and I think over the years I sold 10 contracts. I guess I just wasn't very good at it. The only 10 I sold were when the CPA and the accountant said, we're doing estate planning, you go buy something. Then it's like taking an order of French fries at McDonald's or something. You know, it's pretty easy. You just write it up and get her done. There are some new concepts out there with long-term care on investment-grade life contracts that's quite attractive that can kind of do some of the same thing. And we're doing a lot of those. And so that, and we're not, that doesn't cover this part. But we have to get creative on this because they can either spend down their assets and go in the county, or they can have a long-term care contract worth $300,000 to $500,000 of benefits and never go on the county or go on the county at a much later time. So, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, they never go on the county. It's a state federal program, medical assistance. So they might apply through the county, but it is primarily those are the resources. But what we've learned in Health and Human Services is that if you really want to use tax policy to help lift up the burden on the Health and Human Services Committee and reduce dependency, this is probably one of your least efficient ways to go. But these policies are mostly bought by people at the highest income and asset levels, and they are at little risk of going on medical assistance, most of them, compared to the average Minnesotan who isn't able to save enough to cover their basic living costs. And I'd say if we're going to use tax policy to reduce long-term dependency, we should really look at incentives for people to save for their pensions and 401ks and provide for their basic living, because many of them have misunderstood how little Social Security is. We've never gotten above 40% with pensions. And the average cost over your lifetime once you get on Medicare for out-of-pocket costs is $250,000, and most people do not retire with $250,000 in any kind of retirement savings to handle those kinds of things. There's just a recent article about the increasing number of seniors who are going on food support, the Supplemental Nutrition Program, because they can't, out of what they've got with retirement savings, Social Security, and anything else, they can't afford just the basics from month to month. And the sad thing about this is I believe in long-term care insurance for some people who have high assets and who have the ability to financially plan. But, you know, it's not a bit. There's a lot of people who buy it when they're healthy and they've got the paycheck coming in and they can afford it. There's growing evidence that lots and lots of people drop it in their 60s and their 70s when they're early retirees because they can't afford the premium and the cost of living without that paycheck. And so they drop it just before they're going to really need it. Some have a limited benefit that you still get some benefit from it, but well, I think the goal of us planning long-term and helping people long-term is a good goal. I think there's some serious questions about whether this is an efficient route.
And two points, Representative Loeffler, thank you very much for that. People aren't dropping these. There may be some anecdotal situations where they do, but some of these plans are blowing up because the companies factored in that they would be dropping it and they're not. People do not drop these as a rule. Some do. And brilliant to drop a policy right before you need it, but whatever. And the other thing, for the record, please have it be known that I said go on the county if you will, meaning that everybody thinks they're going on the county, but you are correct, Representative Loeffler, on that. We have quite a list here. Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Just real quickly, Representative O'Driscoll, I think this is a great bill. I have several in my district that when I see them often at the grocery store, especially Bob, who is not in the upper bracket, like someone said over on that side, by no means, but has always wanted me for the last 6 years to increase it to a $200 deductible credit. So this is going to be great news when I see him at the milk section at Coburn's tomorrow or this weekend. So thank you. I did spend about a half an hour to 45 minutes with Luke Bauman, my insurance guy in Delano, regarding long-term care. Went through all the numbers, and I just felt old even going through that and even looking at it, so I kind of put it off and procrastinated again and said, well, I'll look at it when I get older. But the fact is, at
you're
50,
old.
Yeah, I'm old, yeah. 50, it is a very important decision that someone can make, and certainly preserves the assets for those who worked hard all their life. And we do need to offer more incentives and more credits to encourage folks to go this route. And I encourage the committee to support this, and thank you for bringing this forward as well.
You know, when I said qualified plan, it should have been a qualified partnership plan, part of the partnership program, so you can get some better benefits there. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Mr. Michael was found a graph that does show the benefit of the tax credit going to very high-income populations in Minnesota. So 32% of the tax expenditure for the credit goes to the top 10% of the population with the most income, 21% to the highest 10%. So of 60% of the population in Minnesota, only 12% get a tax benefit from this credit. So it really is geared towards higher-income populations that are receiving most of the credit, not towards those who would qualify for Medicaid. So that's probably why the research has found that there is a the credits exceed the cost of the tax credit exceeds the savings we would gain from our state expenditures on the Medicaid program. And I just like to enter this chart into the public record somehow.
I don't know how you do that. Okay. Medicaid, members, this is not for someone on Medicaid. When you go through, and as Representative Grunhagen knows and others, you have to go through suitability. This is not for somebody that's on Medicaid or has less than X number dollar worth of assets. You have to have some assets, but all my clients that take this on the new program that we use, they're not rich, but they're going to save the farm. They're going to save the family business because they did this. Okay, with that, anyone else? Representative Carlson, then we'll go to the next bill. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I've got two questions. What happens if you never utilize that insurance? And what percentage of that $62,000 will ultimately perhaps not ever exercise it because they were blessed with good health or...
Representative Carlson, the plans we're talking about here are use it or lose it plans. Some can have a rider on that's quite expensive where you would get a refund after you had it 10, 20, or 30 years.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
most plans are use it or lose it.
Yeah, that's what I thought I remembered, and that's why I was asking the question. You know, I when this was first passed, I looked at it carefully for my wife and I, and I got the pencil out and decided, by the way, I don't save for retirement. I invest for retirement. There's a difference. In that, because
I save for retirement and invest for retirement. That's why I've got some for retirement.
What my savings are, they're invested in that. But anyway, that's where I'm headed with this. So when I got the pencil out, you know, thought if I, and I looked at life expectancy and what have you. Now, you never know when you're going to be ill, but I'm 76 and blessed so far with good health.
And looking good.
And at any rate, it didn't turn out to be, in my view, a good investment if I were to, which I did ultimately do along with other investment dollars, continue to invest in my portfolio, and over time was doing much better than what I would have with the insurance because it is a terminal plan. Now, admittedly, there's a little bit of risk there, but it truly was not a good incentive from my perspective, especially when I looked at it for both my wife and I, the amount that we'd be putting in per month, even with a tax credit, just didn't appear to be a wise investment from my perspective. So I would, you know, I don't have a big problem with the bill, but I would suggest that anybody that's looking at that probably get the pencil out and see under what circumstances, if you saved or invested an equivalent amount of money, where you would be over a given period of time, especially when you look at things like life expectancy. Now, I was barraged, probably everybody in the committee was, when I was younger when this first passed. Now they don't contact me at all because I suppose at 76 they view me as too high a risk. The premium would probably be out of sight as well now.
Yeah. I could get you covered.
I'm sure you could, but it'd be the question of how much it would cost.
Chair Carlson.
I'd be out with that pencil again.
Yeah. Well, every client I have that's in the nursing home, their families are very happy that they have the contracts. That's all I've noticed. Okay, Chair Carlson.
Okay, no, point I wanted to make was that I asked that question just to put it on the table, that it is terminal. The other point I wanted to make was that, that people should really look at other savings slash investments over a period of time and just see how well they would come out relative to that investment. But that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Chair Detmer.
Yeah, thank you. Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. In fact, I don't even remember when I was 50 years old. But anyway. Yeah. But my father's 93. He still lives at his home. And years ago, he took out a policy. And he's got somebody coming into his home, you know, twice a month to clean and so forth. So it really helps him out. And I'm a fixed income and a retired farmer, too. It's encouraging us to do the same thing, which I haven't taken the steps to do so.
Okay, we'll talk later, Chair Detmer. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just want to thank Representative Odisco for bringing this forward and just point out that, former state demographer Tom Gillespie indicated that the growth rate in health care, which includes long-term care costs, is going to bankrupt the state. And we have testimony this session already that the growth rate in Medicaid here in the state is at a rate that is simply unsustainable. In other words, eventually all money is going to be spent in the HHS area, but nothing for roads or bridges or higher ed or K-12. But anyway, the tax code has been used to as a social engineering tool to incentivize certain types of behavior, and to the degree that we can do that with long-term care, which I completely agree with Representative Driscoll's comments, a crisis is coming in this particular area. And I've seen people, I have another agent that sells long-term care in my office, but the ones who have used it or needed it, it's been a great blessing for them at time claims. So I strongly recommend that we continue to work in the direction of allowing some tax deductibility, state and federal, on these types of programs. And I think it'll help the state Medicaid budget going forward eventually.
Thank you, Mr. Gruenhagen. Chair Carlson, to wrap it up.
I'm not necessarily opposed to it. In fact, the very arguments you just laid were the arguments that were used at the time. But if you remember, my initial comments or questions were the disappointment in the participation rate.
Mm-hmm.
It never got to the point where some of us hoped that it would. And my only point was, if you're looking at buying it, be sure you get that pencil out to make sure that for you as an individual, that's true with any investment, you know, at a certain age you are advised probably not to engage in risky investments, whatever they may be. You know, that's usually the advice of your advisors if you're using one for investments. I think you have to take a good look and see if that's a good investment. And for some people, it probably is a part of its timing, and it probably was a good investment. I didn't feel it would be a good investment for my wife and I, not that I was opposed to others buying into the program.
And thank you, Chair Carlson. You're absolutely right. I mean, it has been disappointing, the low numbers of people that actually have participated. Because, and again, the credit here going for 100, 200, that's not going to set the world on fire by any means, but to start, and I agree with Representative Driscoll, that we need to start somewhere and work on this, but you're exactly right, Chair Carlson. It has been disappointing, the few number of people that have participated. So with that, anything else from the public testimony department? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Cummings. Wrap it up, if you would, please, Chair Driscoll.
Just a couple of final thoughts. The same conversation we're having about what happens with long-term care could be with people who are contributing to a 401k, to IRAs. There are tax deductions and incentives to do that. If you're in the lower income bracket, the federal government has even allowed a tax credit for people who fund IRAs and the like. The question becomes, are they good for people to do that? Yes. What we have to have is conversation that we've had today and education of our population about what lies ahead and why these types of products are important. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chair Driscoll. I'll renew my motion to House File 260 be labeled for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Item next. Let's go with 244 very quickly, just to get that, because that has a sense of urgency. Mr. Suleman, then we'll spend the rest of the committee meeting on Chair Anderson S.'s bill. So, members, if you could please go to House File 244. This shouldn't take too long. And this is one we'll actually be voting on because Mr. Solm will make a very compelling case in my mind of what needs to be done here to save Western civilization as we know it. So that being said, I will move House File 244 to the General Register. I'll move House File 244. I will move the H024482 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now we have the bill before us as amended. First of all, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns thereof? Okay, so we'll go with Mr. Sulem, and then we'll go with member question. Oh, the department? Yeah, we do need you up. Yeah, we always need you, of course, but we do need your testimony on this. Mr. Sulem, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and tell us about your bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sulem, General Counsel and Director of Governmental Relations for the Minnesota Association of Townships. The bill before you is a cut-and-paste provision from the 2016 Omnibus Tax Bill. It's a negotiated agreement with the Department of Revenue and other interested players that simply gives a one-time waiver for the training mandate to the local boards of appeals and equalization. What happened was in last year there were some changes in dates and certification and whatnot, and we had townships that certified by February 1, the deadline they must certify to the county that they're in compliance through their local boards of appeals. Through no fault of their own, by the time the actual hearings occurred in late March and April, the trained officer was no longer on the town board. In some cases, they had passed away. A couple of cases, they had moved into nursing homes outside the township limit. And a few others had lost their local election at the March town election. These townships immediately sought to have an additional member certified using the department's online training, only to find that the training had been shut off on February 1st. So they were in a gotcha situation. They were trying to comply. They were in compliance. They wanted to stay in compliance. And through odd situations, they fell out of compliance. Without this bill, they will not be able to certify by February 1st this year that they are back in compliance, which means that they will forfeit their right to do the local boards of appeals and equalization for the current year and two subsequent years, at which time they can petition the county to try to get it back. We think that's a harsh penalty for a situation that was not through anybody's fault. We've been able to work with the Department of Revenue on increased training and on increased notice, so we don't have that same situation arise this year. They do now offer emergency training that we can advise our members on should a unique situation arise. And so, again, I simply ask for your support that this bill needs to be signed, sealed, and delivered by Tuesday, or we can't certify on February 1st that the towns are in compliance. Thank you.
No, we're not changing future training or we're not going there. We're just
Mr. Chair, there's no change in training requirements. There's no change in how we're doing the training. There's no cost. There's no change in anything other than allowing that one-time waiver so they can certify. They were in compliance a year ago. They'll be back in compliance this year. We just have to cover that gap where they were out of compliance in 2016.
Because you could have the trained people that move or resign as a township officer.
Correct.
Because they had no long-term care insurance, they died, type of thing. Okay, through the department, then we'll go to member questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Well, you are the author, too, Mr. Chair. So, and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I was able to connect with you last week, Mr. Chair, and we thank you for your work on this bill. We just wanted to reiterate the importance of the February 1st deadline. It is necessary because the county assessor must set the type of meeting, open book, or local board of equalization, time and date by February 15th, according to Minnesota statutes. This date must be announced in the newspaper and on the valuation notice. In order to set the date and the type of meeting, the assessor needs to know which districts have a trained member and which ones do not in a timely way. Accordingly, the township clerk needs to notify the assessor by February 1st so that the date and the type of meeting can be set. Offering training after February 1st would confuse the question of whether the statutory deadline for training had been met. Ensuring deadlines and training requirements are met is important. If, however, there are unforeseen circumstances after a member is already trained and the board has previously met the requirements, we can work with townships. For example, if a trained board member dies or steps down from the town board before the March township meetings, we allow new members to be certified and make up sessions. In those cases, the dates and types of hearing has already been set. Mr. Chair, we had worked to ensure that counties understood that After last session, we worked with the Minnesota Association of Townships, so we have an updated email and other notification list to ensure township officers know about this makeup opportunity. With the February 1st deadline fast approaching, county officials will need some certainty how to handle these local boards of equalization, whether they should be boards or open books. It is important for all of our customers and property taxpayers that they have the clarity about what to expect from their local boards of equalization. Having a training completed on or before February 1st provides that clarity and transparency. So, Mr. Chair, to be abundantly clear, this bill needs to be enacted, not just passed by the House, by February 1st, in order to ensure a property tax system will be works well for our customers. In addition, Mr. Chair, this as a clean bill is something that we understand and is administrable, but any other additions to this bill could make this bill something that would be less likely to be enacted, Mr. Chair.
Like amending on House File 848? For example?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't want to speculate, Mr. Chair. we want to be partners with the townships in meeting these training requirements. We think that we have worked in good faith to meet the needs of our customers. We're always open to hearing feedback and ways that we can work better, and we're continuing that conversation. We have experts here from our department, if that is helpful, and as this bill moves through the process, we look forward to working with you and the townships and other members, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Mr. Cummings, for your efforts on this bill. This is a very important bill in all seriousness to our friends at the township, in township government. Questions for members? Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sullivan, am I correct in saying that no one is opposed to this bill? It costs nothing, and the chief author of this bill is the Honorable Chairman of the Tax Committee, Representative Greg Davids.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, to the best of my knowledge, those are all absolutely true statements.
For the record.
I think we're fully informed. We're ready to vote, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Oh, excuse me. Representative Metzen. Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a good bill, and to show how quick it needs to get on the floor, I'm just going to quit talking and turn it over to Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Davids, for bringing this forward. I'd ask members to vote yes. This, while not a big thing in the large scheme of things, it is very, very important to these townships, and we know setting the value of property is the first step in that whole property tax system. So it's very timely. We need to get this done, and I know of no other intent by the chairman other than to pass this bill, so I appreciate that and ask members to vote yes.
Thank you very much, Chair Marquardt. Any other questions? Chair Carlson.
A question I have asked you in the past, and this is not a vehicle bill.
This is not a vehicle bill, and if anybody tries anything, this is not a vehicle bill.
I just want to remind you, we haven't passed the House budget resolution yet, so
yeah. No.
Anything could happen.
Well, that's true, but...
I know that at times this committee and Ways and Means have reported out, sometimes just park vehicle bills, but I'm picking up on what Mr. Cummings said, just to clarify that it's not a vehicle bill.
And Chair Carlson, when I have those bills, you will figure it out quickly.
I usually know.
Sure.
Yeah.
This is not one of those. Chair Garofalo.
Yeah, and I want to correct something that people are under the misconception that it is true we don't have a budget resolution right now, but if you look at the House rules when there isn't a budget resolution, look up Rule 4.05, I believe, and you'll see that that doesn't mean that we can offer amendments to spend money.
That's right.
I would. People should look up House Rule 4.05, that when there's not a budget resolution, I'm summarizing here, but no amendments to spend any money can be offered.
How am I going to do that?
Oh, yeah. No. Any other questions for the witness or the author? I will renew my motion that House File 244 as amended be moved to the general register. Any further discussion? Hearing all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members.
Thank you,
Mr. Sulem. Thank you, Department. Mr. Cummings. Are you going to roll call? There was not a roll call last week, please. Okay. Chair Anderson S., welcome to your tax committee. Chair Anderson S. will move House File 328. I do not see any amendments. And members, you should have on your agenda for the day, we have a very robust list of folks that would wish to testify. You can see them there. So I'm just going to list Steve Wise, Gary Aiken, Deb McMillan, Beth Cadoon, Mike Hickey, Nan Madden. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify on behalf of or with concerns thereof on this bill? So the list that we have is the list we will use. Welcome to your committee. Chair Anderson asks if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is an issue that's familiar to the committee because we've heard it in the past. And Mr. Chair, I know your love for music, and I view you as a person of more of a lover than a fighter when it comes to these issues. And I can't help but think about the people that are impacted by the current way that we collect income taxes. These are mom-and-pop shops that are having to run their income through their business income through their personal income taxes, and as a result, they get hit with a higher tax rate. And what this bill does is it tries to give them some relief, and we've talked here in the committee about wealth migration and what that means to the state in the long term and our maintaining our sustainability. And you being the chair that you are, Mr. Chair, you know, I just say that this is a moment for us to let's stay together, and, you know, times are good or bad. This is, you know, a bill that we can probably put forward that would bring everybody together. So I'm trying to help you out here, Mr. Chair, with some things. I've got some testifiers here today, and I'm hoping you guess the song that that's miserably.
I can do that. And it's not something in the air by Thunderclap Newman either.
No.
I should know that. So.
Okay. So.
How many people have heard Thunderclap Newman? I just have to say for the record.
You just talked about the other day, Mr. Chair.
Yes, we did. Representative Lesh, very important. My song of the day 2 days ago was Something in the Air by Thunderclap Newman. It was a band, a one-hit wonder. That was kind of it for them. They were managed by Pete Townsend. And as I went through the day asking everybody who wrote Something in the Air, there's one person that got it right. Ron Elwood. I mean, he just went, oh, that's Thunderclap Newman. I went, wow. Is that impressive or what, Chair?
Mr. Chair, do you know what Mr. Elwood does in his spare time?
I think he's a musician, isn't he?
He's a drummer in a Grateful Dead cover band.
Really?
Well, it has been in the past. I haven't checked in with Mr. Elwood recently, but I've actually seen him perform.
Is he playing Saturday night, the Holiday Inn Express, or...?
You'd have to check with his performance schedule with him. I'm a fan, not his manager.
Okay. I thought that was amazing, though. I mean, Thunderclap Newman. Okay. We have a bill before us, Mr. We do. Okay. A wonderful bill. House file 328. Let's just go down the list here. Now, first of all, well, let's just go down the list. Mr. Steve Wise, Cast Crew Machine, if you could please come down, sir. And why don't we get a couple of those two chairs there? Let's bring down Mr. Gary Aiken, Tonka Financial.
Something in the air.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Greetings, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Wise. I'm from Casco Machine Products in Brooklyn Center.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. If I may give you a little background on Casco Machine Products, we are a precision manufacturer in Brooklyn Center. We have 125,000 square feet of manufacturing, 120 employees right now. We make parts, nuts, bolts, screws, bearings, shafts. We don't have a product of our own. We make other people's parts. So we don't have a sales force. We don't really control much of our supply chain. As our customers go, that's kind of how our economy is. That's how our microeconomy is. When I say customers like Bobcat, Polaris, Toro, Arctic Cat, those are my big customers. These are all good manufacturers in the region here that I think you'll all recognize. 2015, manufacturing as a whole in our economy was going up on a nice reasonable growth spurt. Fourth quarter, we all saw a precipitous fall. 2016, we were down almost 10%. We expect the same for 2017 going forward here. My customer base, we have a long tenure with all of them, deep relationships and deep roots. But they have huge price pressures right now in the manufacturing industry, as we face as well. They have to, you know, show profits and return on investment for their shareholders, and eventually that goes right down to beating up the little suppliers they've got, like us. This creates a very competitive market in the industry for our precision manufacturers. My competition, as everybody probably knows, we are global and we are regional. I'm going to tell you a little story. One of my biggest customers called me into their global headquarters here back in April, and they said one thing on the agenda: we're going to talk about global competitiveness. I said, "Oh, great! Here we go! Here we go!" So I go down there, and they had one thing on the PowerPoint, and basically what it was, they had $1.5 million of my parts up on this screen, and they said, "We're going to move these parts. We can buy them 40% cheaper in the Czech Republic. What are you going to do about it?" I could do nothing about it, obviously. I can't give them 40%, I can't give them 5%. So those, with a couple of mouse clicks, those parts are gone. So that kind of tells us that we have a tough time competing globally against pressures like that. So we focus at CASGRU on our regional competition. So those folks in North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, they've got similar cost structures of us. I know they do. But anecdotally, I know that Iowa, for instance, we are farming some of our parts that we used to make in our shop down to Iowa, to Quality Machine. This was a fellow that used to have a huge manufacturing place up in Brooklyn Park. He's now in Iowa making parts down there. We have the same wage structure. We buy the same materials, the same machines, same health care costs, same business insurances. But I can't match his costs, so I'm buying parts from him in Iowa to sell to my customers. But we're here to talk about pass-through income. I know a little bit about that. CAS has been a pass-through entity since 1991, so I understand the mechanism. What we do is we figure out our profitability, and what we would do then is take the pass-through estimated taxes for the shareholders and mail that into the state and federal government every quarter for our shareholders. Pretty simple equation. Interestingly, I hired a new controller back in March, and she came from environment that was an S corporation, I'm sorry, a C corporation, so she was not used to this. So I was talking kind of through the steps, and she got down to figuring out the profitability on our company for the second quarter. And she said, so how much cash should I free up to mail in for our estimates for our shareholders? I said, half. And she was dumbfounded. She said, half? I said, well, figure it out. It's 40% for the federal and 10% for the state. It's half. So figure out that profitability, free up the cash, and mail it in. It's staggering when you think about it that way. Last night we had a gathering about 500 manufacturers, and I was talking about testifying to one of them, and he said, so you're going to testify about that 2% that the state wants to take from you. He said, what's that going to mean to you? And I said, well, it depends on our profitability, 15, 20, 30,000, depends on the profitability. And he looked at me like I was an idiot. What am I going all the way down here to talk about $20,000 in a shop like mine? But you know what, it's not just this $20,000, it's the property tax, it's the health care, it's everything else that we face, and it's death by 1,000 cuts, you guys. We just want to stay healthy. We're a proud Minnesota manufacturer, and so that's why I'm here today. So, simple equation for us when we're faced with fixed costs we can't control. We've got to work harder and longer to cover them, and that decreases our profitability, or we can pass our costs along to our customers, which is their bulletin. We're not allowed to pass any cost increases along to our customers. And what would that trigger? That would trigger them to go shop regionally for similar parts. Our mission is to provide livelihoods for 125 families, good jobs, health insurance, and retirement. Part of that mission is we negotiate all of our costs ferociously, from paper to oil to materials. I appreciate this committee doing my negotiating for me, since this is something I can't negotiate myself. Thank you.
Your employees have long-term care coverage?
No, they do not.
Well, you mentioned, you know, just $20,000. Well, you know, $20,000 here and $20,000 there, pretty soon you're talking $40,000.
It adds up.
Okay, we'll go through everyone. So can everybody stick around that's going to testify for the committee? Because then we'll go through the testimony then. And if somebody could kind of shorten, I mean, that was wonderful testimony, but let's watch the time a little bit here. Mr. Gary Aiken, and then we'll go to member questions. And department, you're on this one?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay. Mr. Gary Aiken.
Hi. Mr. Chairman, my name is Gary Aiken. I'm president of Tonka Financial.
Sir, can you please get a little closer to my phone there?
My name is Gary Aiken. I'm president of Tonka Financial. I'm a financial advisor. I have a practice in Minnetonka. I work out of my home with 5 employees. We're a small family business. But I'm not going to talk too much about myself. It's what my clients that I experience with, and I'm going to talk and share those experiences. We do a lot of financial planning. So we do a lot of helping people retire. And unfortunately, we help a lot of people move out of the state of Minnesota. A lot of these people, I specialize in small business because my past is I was a business consultant at one time and worked a lot, and I have a relationship and understand. I'm not a tax expert, but I was a VITA volunteer, volunteer income tax assistance for the federal government back in the 80s and the late 70s. So I have a little experience, and those experiences have helped me very much in helping my clients. I also, Tonka Financial is also a MinSure preferred assistor for SHOP in the individual plans both. And we do health care for both on and off exchange. We do long-term care. We do all the insurances. But we primarily also specialize in very sophisticated investments, something called alternative investments. They're very restricted and you have to have certain asset requirements and so forth. And they're generally considered very illiquid, so therefore they're very high net worth accredited investor. But most of our investors are small business people, and that's what I'm here to talk about. Because basically I was just thinking, I don't have the exact numbers, but about for sure 95%. In fact, I can only think of 6 C-Corps of all the hundreds of people that we've helped in the last year. I'm one of them, so I actually am not an S-Corp, I'm a C-Corp, but I'm kind of a rare bird in Minnesota. But the taxes are a very, very onerous thing that we have in this state. And anything we can do to help the small business, and the small business I'm talking about, my average small business person is 4 to 5 people down to 2 or 3. They're very, very small. And they wake up every day. They're not as fortunate. You know, Steve's got the threat of a global. They just wake up every day and hope the phone rings or someone will answer their phone call so they can be in business another day. That's the fear they live by. And taxes, I really think, are unfair, especially for a small business person. Now, I've been around a little bit longer, not quite as long as Representative Carlson, but I've been around. And I got to tell you, I remember in the 80s, at one time in the 80s, this state was the Silicon Valley of the country. Do you remember that? Anybody recall that? Do you recall that?
Yeah.
Okay, also, we were the drug pharma developer that led to St. Jude and a few other great companies that are slowly being purchased and being phased out. Those were all little drug companies started in the garage in the 80s. We don't have that anymore. Look at the tax code you had back then in the state of Minnesota. Look what you have now. We have to get innovative and help these small businesses. And I think this bill, ladies and gentlemen, is exactly a good start to help these young entrepreneurship, young businesses like I have. And by the way, half the business I have weren't even existence of businesses 5 years ago that I have as clients. That's all I have to say, except for one thing. There is kind of a personal matter here. If you do not let this bill go, I want to thank you for the continued job security on the financial planning side.
Okay, let's go.
We're doing questions or at the
end? No, we're going to, at the end, everybody can stick around, so we'll do it that way. I've got a question for Ms. Manzi. In the write-up here, it says income from business, comma, farm, S corporation, comma, or partnership. So that'd be an LLC, LLP, but if the business is sole proprietorship, that wouldn't apply, right? It'd have to be a business or a farm that is an S corp, an LLC, or an LLP. Well, I don't read the bill, so I'm just looking up the summary here. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, this would apply to a sole proprietor, and in many cases that's going to be an LLC where they've opted to be a disregarded entity. But, yes, it's any active trade or business income.
And I'm not questioning Ms. Manzi's work, because she's always right. But, okay. Okay, thank you. Let's go to Ms. McMillan, then on deck, Ms. Cadoon, then Mr. Hickey, then Ms. Madden, then the department, then questions, because everybody can stick around here. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Chair Davids and committee members, I'm Deb McMillan. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Twin West Chamber of Commerce.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Twin West represents more than 700 member businesses in the western suburbs of the Twin Cities. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 328, and I want to thank Representative Anderson for her tireless work on this issue. The 2013 personal income tax rate increase had the unintended consequence of hitting private sector businesses who passed their business income through their personal tax return particularly hard. In fact, 92% of Minnesota businesses, most of which are small LLCs, partnerships, and sole proprietors, are impacted by this tax. Also important to note is the fact that these pass-through businesses employ more than half of Minnesota's private sector employees. Reducing taxes on business income leaves more money available for reinvestment in their businesses and in their employees. We encourage you to support this legislation and take a step toward making Minnesota's business climate more competitive. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Cadoon and Mr. Hickey. Ms. Cadoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, an organization of 2,300 businesses across the state of Minnesota. I'm also here representing the United for Jobs Coalition. I did a handout that you should be getting right now. And on the back is listing the 80 partners in this coalition, many of the local chambers of commerce and business associations that are in support of how we can reduce the tax on pass-through entities. As was mentioned by Ms. McMillan, she really highlighted how this really is truly our individual income tax does truly impact the business taxation in the state. We're third highest in the nation, as you know, on the individual income tax side, which means that we're also third highest on our pass-through entities. That is where we're seeing our job creation in the state. They employ over half of our private sector is employed by these companies. And we need to find a way how we can improve our business tax climate, which is obviously a theme you continue to hear from me, again and again, is really the need to focus on those taxes. We were out of alignment with the rest of the nation. This is one where we're in the top five. I really believe we need to get out of there. High marginal income tax has shown that it does undermine investment, entrepreneurship, and investment in innovation in the state. And so we feel that this is very important if you're trying to find ways how we can really strengthen Minnesota, how we can improve the economy, make sure we're really best positioned for future growth. This is one of those taxes that we feel you really do need to focus on and find ways to reduce so we can be more competitive and even the playing field for a lot of our current businesses, which is also very important. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Mr. Hickey, NFIB. And if you could stick around, folks, because there may be questions. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. And we're here to give strong support to Representative Anderson's bill and thank her for bringing this up again. I think we discussed this a couple of years ago in this very room with you also. And this is an important step we need to make. National Federation of Independent Business, I know I keep saying this, but just to remind you, represents 11,000 small businesses and farms across the state. We probably are the most affected group of this bill, but obviously, as the other witnesses pointed out, this has a big impact on the private sector. Virtually everyone in small business these days is a flow-through company of some sort, sub-S, LLC. A lot of people advertise it, as you see, on their letterhead or on their signs or whatever. And this is an important step to make. We really thought it was a big mistake, what we did in the 2013 tax bill. And we're really making Minnesota look unappealing with the third highest top rate in the country. And who does this affect? It affects successful small business people who are bringing income in, and they're more than likely hiring more people than people who are struggling. Someone showing a loss, someone has a company in a downturn, is not having the same positive impact, even though we're pulling for that person, they're not having the same positive impact on our economy as someone who is bringing in income that does trigger this fourth rate of taxation. And this would be a very helpful step to making us more competitive and to urging people to stay here and not consider expansion options elsewhere. So we appreciate this bill, and I think it's an important piece to improving Minnesota's overall tax climate.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. And we will now go to Ms. Nan Madden, and the department's up next, and then member questions. Ms. Madden? welcome to the committee. If you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Excuse me. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are a research and advocacy organization that promotes public policies to expand economic opportunity in Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to express some concerns with House File 328. Those are largely the cost of this bill and some of the ways that it creates an uneven playing field among taxpayers. This bill provides tax cuts of $353 million in the 18-19 biennium. That's 25% of the projected surplus. So that is a large portion of the surplus to dedicate to tax cuts for about 21,000 taxpayers. So again, just want to emphasize the point I've made a couple times about there'll be a number of choices you'll need to make this session and whether that's a priority over other choices you could make or other investments you could make to support small businesses this session. You know, we all sometimes use the shorthand of describing the businesses that pay taxes on their profits through the individual income tax as being small businesses. But it's important to remember that whether a business's profits are taxed on the corporate tax or on the individual income tax is based on the business's structure that the owners have chosen. It is not based on the size of the business measured by the number of employees or the revenues. So the businesses that pay taxes on their profits through the individual income tax do include the small family restaurant, farms or hardware stores, but also a range of other professionals who structure their businesses that way, and there isn't a size limit on how big they can be. So there are some options you could consider for a more focused and targeted approach. This bill also creates an uneven playing field by treating similar taxpayers differently. It provides a tax preference for income that comes from business profits that isn't available to those with incomes earned through salaries and wages that can create discrepancies even within the same business. And it provides a tax cut for high-income individuals in some professions that's not available to similarly high-income people but are in other professions. So given the cost of the bill and the uneven playing field, you know, those are our concerns with the bill, and again, ask you to consider some more targeted alternatives.
And Ms. Madden, we've had five people supporting the bill. You have some concerns, so I don't want you cutting your stuff short because I want to kind of be somewhat equal time here. So sure. If you have any other comments? Or
That's all I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Anyone else from the audience would like to testify? Mr. Skillbred? And Ms. Mann, can you stick around too if there's questions? Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, sir.
Mr. Chair, my name is David Skillbred. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. What makes us unique is that we are all privately held. In 2014, we helped craft and introduce a bill, which I believe someone at this table authored. And the bill would provide a help to those pass-through businesses on the tax side for the business income. So it would try to provide an exclusion for a reduction or an exemption on the business income. And the reason we tried that was because of this bill coming up. When you add your personal and you add your business income together, then you obviously have more. And about 21,000 or so pass-through businesses got hit with the fourth tier. So in the bottom line is that they're being taxed on money that they really don't get. And that's because most of the business income goes back into the business. So if we could provide some sort of help in those circumstances, it would be very positive. Secondly, if they're in that fourth tier now, we have small businesses paying 9.85% and corporations, big corporations, paying less. We don't think that's really the right way to go. And that's all I'll say. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Skillbred. The department? Then we'll go to member questions. Thank you, Mr. Skobrev.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, a fellow Blazer, Mr. Chair.
Atwater?
Grove City. Atwater, Grove City.
Awesome.
Yes. And members,
Dr. Erdahl was a Husky, I believe. Right? Husky? Okay.
For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Yesterday, I reached out to Representative Anderson's office and left a message there. This bill would apply the fourth tier rate only to taxable income after deducting active trader business income to the extent it exceeds the threshold. This bill would mean that S-Corps, partnerships, and other qualifying people and businesses would have a lower tax rate than wage-earning taxpayers and C-corporations. About 95% of those who would benefit have incomes of $500,000 or more. Using the last complete data set, which was 2012, of the 368,000 returns that reported positive income from a sole proprietor, S-Corp, and partnership, 7.7 had enough total income to have any of their income taxed at the 9.85 rate. Another 114,000 returns reported negative flow-through income. Those with losses had no flow-through income to be taxed. If they were included in the account of business, the 7.7 share would fall to 5.9%. Only 21,000 tax returns would benefit, though the average benefit would be about $8,293 per return. Effective tax rates for those in the top 1% are already lower than those for middle-class Minnesotans earning a wage. Treating different types of income differently can cause unanticipated problems that are difficult to predict, Mr. Chair. Creating this kind of discrepancy in the tax code has been tried in other states and can have a significant impact on individual tax planning and state budget planning. In 2012, Kansas exempted all of this income, creating a similar, though more significant, tax preference. Kansas's pass-through exemption has been extremely costly to their state budget and eventually caused the need for other taxes to be increased. Their ongoing budget issues still remain. If this provision passed, an employee could go to their employer and ask to be paid as an independent contractor. They still would be doing the same job and contributing the same value to the economy. They would just be paying lower income taxes. This happened because it didn't create the kind of economic benefits it was intended to, and instead just resulted in taxpayers and businesses shifting how they file their taxes so they can qualify for the exemption. As noted, Mr. Chair, there are many businesses in Minnesota that do have this type of income, that do have employees, but there would be sort of a dissonance between those and others. Kansas originally projected that 191,000 entities would take advantage of this provision. As more realized the tax advantage of being a pass-through entity in Kansas, that number ended up being 330,000, over 70% more than what was anticipated. But this was not the case of businesses pouring into Kansas. It was merely a difference in how
Mr. Cummings were not in Kansas anymore. Please continue.
The estimate provided today does not account for these changes in behavior that admittedly would be hard to predict. But, Mr. Chair, if this bill moves through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Representative Anderson, members, and staff. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource.
He's good, isn't he? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Chair Garofalo.
Is that the completion of our testimony, Representative?
That, I believe so, unless there's any more public testimony.
I have a question.
Mr. Cummings, why don't you stick around, if you could, please?
The gentleman who is the second testifier, I didn't catch his name, my apologies.
Mr. Aiken. Mr. Aiken, if you could join us, please, sir.
Sure.
And thank you for your testimony. So there's an ongoing long-term debate we've had in this committee about the effect of the higher income taxes that were passed and whether that is causing a wealth migration or not. It seems like this is a sector of the economy that you have personal experience in and dealing with people. So I'll just flat out ask you, did the increase in taxes, did it cause a wealth migration from your perspective or not? And just kind of
yes.
Mr. Aiken.
Yes, thank you for the job security. I'll say that again.
And Mr. Chairman, and to the testifier, were there any other factors that could have caused this besides the increase in the rate to 9.85%? Was there anything, like, for example, we saw similar effects in other states at the same time or migrations from other states? I mean, is there any, how certain are you that this increase in taxes caused a wealth migration from the state?
Mr. Aiken?
Okay.
That means you can talk.
Yeah, okay. Just want to make sure I was, sorry, I talked earlier before. The situation is when people make a decision that they have to retire, and I'm going to say it's not really, really wealthy, wealthy people. They can sometimes afford the extra taxes in Minnesota. I'm talking about people that are average working people, a postal worker, worked all their lives for the post office, somebody that was a hourly employee, saved real hard in their 401k plan. We sit down. We do a comprehensive financial review. During that process, we have very sophisticated tools that we can punch in the state based on their income and their particular personal situation, and we can see what areas would you like to retire other than Minnesota. And we have that discussion. It's my fiduciary responsibility to do that. And it's very amazing. Very few states very few states are as high as we are. You can name the ones. I think one was called California, one was called New York. Maybe you heard those two states. Other than that, you're pretty much, it depends on everybody's situation and what kind of what their holdings are, what their wealth is. You know, everybody's an individual case, but yes. And that is the main disciple. That's the main people I work with. I wish I worked with more multimillionaires. I have a few, but I like to have a lot more. So if you could buy a lottery ticket, give me a call. If you win, I'll be happy to take care of you. But the reality is this. Most of these folks have less than $1 million in net liquid assets, and they're trying to find a way where they can live cheaply in their retirement. And the biggest thing they emotionally go through, well, my kids are here. I've grown up in Minnesota. I'm a Minnesotan. But you know what? I can't retire when I want to if I continue to be a Minnesota resident. That's my experience. It's anecdotal, but I can tell you that and I can think of four or five families in the last couple of months that I've helped that way recently. And they made a decision. Wisconsin is better than Minnesota.
Ooh.
I just want to throw that out. I have my own family members who retired in Wisconsin very happily. And first thing to tell me, boy, you really, this tax thing is really, it's really different here. This argument that, you know, the hourly wages, by the way, about, you know, that's onerous too. You know, they're the people that really need the help. The business people, they're going to start a business because they want to get more out of life. They're not trying to cheat anybody. They're not rich people. They're trying to be rich. Is that a sin? That's what this bill does. It helps the people trying to be rich. When you try to help somebody be more successful, long term, are they going to pay more taxes to the state coffers or less? I'll let you answer that question yourself. My belief is that if we could help people, and that was the point I was trying to make, if we can get to an economy that's tax-friendly, that helps small entrepreneurships and small people and small business, we will have a more vibrant economy in this state. If you look at our history and some of the big corporations we've got here, it's because they had somebody a long time ago in a garage or in a little mill somewhere or something had a dream to get richer. Somewhere in retail, I believe, too. That's the thing I think that we have to think about. That's the long view we have to look on these kind of bills. It isn't about a short-term change thing. Because if these small businesses are successful, according to this bill, it's progressive. They pay more. They want to pay more in taxes because they want to make more money. So let's give them the break, because that's the piece that we're really killing, is the small business people. We're worried about, I think John Menard's the largest S-Corp. I don't know. You have to boot me on that. I heard he was an S-Corp. We're not talking about John Menard's here. We're talking about people that lost their job or quit their job or, you know, risk everything they have to start this small business. That's the majority of people. How many people did you say lost money? 118,000? Did I hear that number right?
Doesn't that tell you something? And you're trying to tax these little people? And you're saying that they don't make the same money as wage earners? Well, they're taking a risk. I think I've pointed it out before. So, sorry. Got me going. Apologize.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman Grapple.
Oh, thank
you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the testifier, Atkins, is the
person. Chair Aiken.
Aiken answered most of my questions with his comment. And I just wanted to add that thank you, Representative Sarah Anderson, for bringing this bill forward. And again, you know, economics 101, it's the accumulation of capital in the private market by entrepreneurs and risk takers, which we've talked about before, that actually will produce more tax revenues in the future. They will start the next 3M. They will start the next Medtronic. To the degree that we punish them with higher and higher tax rates, you ultimately reduce tax revenues, and we can't meet the needs of the citizens with the that are most critical in the state of Minnesota. I think we all have to come to that conclusion. If we don't, I mean, we're beating the goose that lays the golden egg of tax revenues to death. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Aiken, can you answer yes or no to this question?
No, we can't.
do the postal workers and those that you help with their finances, those that are not wealthy, are they going to reach that top tax bracket in Minnesota?
Mr. Aiken.
No.
Okay.
Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question I could go to Representative Anderson, but why not extend it to, why limit this bill to those of higher income? Why not? I did private consulting and was a sole proprietor, LLC, S corporation. I wouldn't benefit from this bill because I didn't make as much money, $260,000. I made much, much less, but I paid a higher tax. So why not open it up to all income levels?
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. If you're interested in lowering all the income tax rates in the state of Minnesota, I'll sign on the bill with you.
Mr. Chair, but just for this bill, though, why are we restricting it to those above an income level? Why not just make it more fair?
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. This piece of legislation is designed to help those individuals that have pass-through income that is going through their business income, that's going through their personal income taxes. And the issue that we have right here is rather than them investing that money back into their business, they're having to pay the state. And how does that impact all of us across the state of Minnesota? It impacts us and our ability to have good-paying jobs in our community. If we all look at our small businesses across the state of Minnesota, they are the economic engine for the state. And that's not just me saying that. That's Governor Dayton saying that as well. He has done a Baxter Healthcare Group out of Brooklyn Park. He's invested tax benefits to that business to create 60 high-paying jobs in that area. You have the governor's tax proposal itself. It's all about how can we generate more jobs and more business growth here in the state. Because at the end of the day, that's what keeps our economy going. That's what makes our budget sustainable. That's what makes us a great state to live and work and raise a family.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it only wealthy people can create jobs? The middle-income folks are not as valued as highly in the business community because they're creating fewer jobs or they have no employees and it's just their sole proprietor? I mean, so we just want to only, do we believe that it's only the wealthy folks that make over $260,000 can create the jobs in the economic development?
Chair Anderson S.
Representative Schultz, as the testifiers provided to you earlier, these aren't just wealthy folks. They might have had a banner year that bumps them up into that fourth-tier tax bracket, and then it punishes them for that economic growth. So I have some letters from different folks across the state of Minnesota have sent to me their stories. In one case, the fellow had a bad year in 2013. Then in 2014, he recovered, gets bumped up into that fourth tax bracket, so all the growth that he had in 2014 gets wiped away. But he had a bad year in 2013 and wasn't in that tax bracket. So you're punishing the economic success and making it difficult for him to actually invest back into his business, hire more people, pay better wages, and make our state a better place to live.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just don't follow the logic, because if we believe that it helps those at over a certain income level, we wouldn't also see benefits from helping those below that income level as well.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, again, if you want to put the legislation forward, I'm happy to co-author with you.
Representative Schultz? Representative Lesch? Representative Metza?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess it's to the department. You don't need to respond, but I'm sure you've got a map that could let me know how many dots of these 20,000 returns would be in my area.
Mr. Cummings? Why don't you join us here so we get it on the tape? I know there's one in my area.
What's your name? I know where they are.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Metza, that is, I don't know whether we would be able to provide that. We certainly would not be able to do the pinpoint thing. But these are all...
Mr. Chair, maybe to make it easier, by zip code, I know, like...
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, these are a private tax type. And so there are points in which when that number is aggregated to certain levels, then there can be amounts disclosed on some regional sort of distribution. But once we get into smaller levels of numbers, or once we get into smaller geographic, that's not information that we're able to provide. And that is for taxpayer confidentiality. There is a point in terms of a zip code, if you sort of know the four people in town that would be that, you know, income tax is something that they have confidence in the Department of Revenue that information would be kept private. If people would be able to find out that three or four people within a jurisdiction would be able to meet this, would be able to be allowed this tax credit, then that would be a disclosure, and that would not be something that we could do. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure about the pass-through elements. There are elements. I don't know how easy that is for people to distinguish, or researchers are able to distinguish. If Chair Anderson or Representative Metza were to work with Ms. Templin to put in a request to our tax research division, that's something that they could figure out. But I know that there have been some requests in the past, but I did want to make it very clear that, you know, that providing information about that could lead to a person identifying a taxpayer is something that we're not able to do.
Representative Metza?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if the President can't release his returns, I guess I wouldn't expect the Department of Revenue to release other people's. I do respect the privacy in all seriousness. So anything we could do to get, I just want to know how it breaks out in my region, who's affected, and pretty tough to go door knocking to see if people are S-Corp or C-Corp, and it would be interesting to know those statistics.
And I respect the President's privacy also. President Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we have a lot of discussion around here oftentimes about fairness and equity and I think even equal playing field, which is a question I have for Ms. Madden. And I think the thing that we fail to remember is that those that are underneath that tax bracket already get the 2% off. I mean, they're not penalized, that 2%. And so we're giving that to the top number because they're the ones that are being penalized for it. The others already get that break, and so they've already got that information. But my question for Ms. Madden revolves around her statement about fairness and equal playing field. Back when I was bowling on Bowling League, how to make it fair, I guess, was we got a handicap in which we were given so many pins if we had a poorer average than somebody else. Now, think about that if we were talking about the Olympics, in which the person that has the highest average automatically, if they're running or swimming, they have so many seconds taken off of their time to make it an even playing field for the others. How would that really impact their training and their drive for success. And oftentimes we think about how we can make it an even playing field by penalizing those that are successful and giving that to those that are not. And we do need to have an obligation to help people up. I mean, I'm not saying that. But aren't we really responsibility is to help enhance their training and skill development and not just taking from and penalizing those that are successful? And so my question for Ms. Madden is, you mentioned in your testimony you wanted to make sure that everybody is on an equal playing field. How do you define equal playing field?
Ms. Madden?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I refer to the even playing field in two specific instances. The first was the situation where you would have two taxpayers of similar income levels, but one gets income through business profits, one gets their income through wages, and under this bill, if these were both higher income individuals in the fourth tier, they would be paying different tax rates based on the source of their income. So, and I think Mr. Cummings spoke to some of the distortions that can sometimes lead to. And then just to underline the point that there are some professions that are more likely or able to switch from being on a salary basis or wage basis to contractor or business owner, so it can create some distortions in that way.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, and I think your first comment probably indicates that you'd be in favor of a flat tax. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Madden?
One of the principles that we have for the tax system is that we would like our tax system to be based on ability to pay and progressive, and actually the way that our complex tax system works right now, we are not at a complete flat system, but there's not a huge amount of variation from the average among income levels. So just to be clear on that.
Representative Petersburg. Chairman Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just a couple of things. One, I'm struck that last week we adamantly established a expectation in this committee that all testimony be research-based and causational. And yet today, here again, we get anecdotes from people. You know, I heard of a guy who had a guy who knew a cousin who he met while he was walking his dog, that they're fleeing the state. And I guess I'd ask if, when public health advocates come before us, that we demand that their testimony be research-based and causational, that when we're looking at tax data and people's behavior, that we hold the same standard as we established for those people last week. So since the department, I won't mention names, but the department referenced Kansas that has a similar policy apparently to what Chair Anderson is suggesting, I looked a little bit and found a number of media reports about businesses leaving the state of Kansas after Governor Brownback was elected and established these policies, particularly those in the technology and healthcare fields, the very fields where we're seeing some of the greatest growth and where, as Chair Anderson's testifier talked about, we've had a deep bench in the state. Now, those are media reports. Maybe those fall under, you know, anecdotal. I think they break a higher threshold than that. But United Van Lines did a study because they move a lot of people here and there and across, and they found that in Kansas, well, for the state of Kansas, 58% of the people that they moved were moving out of the state of Kansas, the sixth worst state in the nation for people fleeing the state. So I would caution us on proposals such as this, and I would also caution us to look at both sides of the equation. I remember door-knocking a gentleman a few years ago, back when, you'll recall, the GOP policy that required that we hold back 40% of the funding for schools each year. And I knew that his district, because of that policy, was one that had to go out and borrow in the private market to make make cash flow so they could pay their teachers and other staff and engage in all the purchasing of materials, you know, things that generate jobs that their district needed to. And I talked with the man, and he said, I informed him that his district was having to go out and borrow because of state policy withholding school funding. And he said, yeah, I know, it's nuts. And he referenced his two middle schoolish looking girls who were in the living room. Said, I had to go out and buy laptops so the girls could do their homework because the school doesn't have textbooks anymore because they can't afford them. So you may have saved this guy $100 on his income tax and cost him 10 times that in the expenses he has to carry so his daughters can get a decent education. So we should look at the whole issue, I would say, comprehensively and factually. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I agree, Chair Dabney. You know, there's more antidotes there. Because did he also say then that more money was withheld from education under DFL houses than Republican houses or not? Chair Dabney.
Mr. Chair, you'll recall during that time period that Minnesota led the nation, was one of only two states in the nation that withheld school funding, that the only other one was California, and that we were more than twice the level of withholding that California does. We were by far the biggest at withholding 40% of the school funding.
Yeah. And Chair Dabney, during that time, but over history, we can take that discussion offline. The next representative, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I was struck by the testimony about the machine tooling industry here as well. When I was a married college student, I went back to work wherever I could find a job, and one of them happened to be in the machine tooling industry down in Cedar Riverside area near the U of M. And that was convenient, but what I learned while I was there, too, is that how extraordinarily competitive this industry is. You know, we look at our fiscal notes, and it's measured in rounding errors of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars. In the machine tooling industry, they bid and they quote manufacturing, whether it's screw machining or milling. They do it in the thousands of parts. So it's dollars per thousand. So when you extrapolate that down to each piece, you're talking thousands of a cent, where the owner literally loses a contract because he was four-tenths of a cent off per piece. That's how extraordinarily competitive some of the businesses are. So, we talk about what Chair Anderson's bill is trying to do. A lot of these entities and organizations are organized as LLCs or sub-S's. They may take a modest salary that doesn't put them in the fourth tier. We've gone through a long recession period where cash is king, capital is hard to get, and the undistributed profits, the retention, the earnings after all is said and done, is a critical component to building and growing that business, of surviving downturns in the economy and keeping employees on board while a contract isn't filled or there's a snafu in terms of production. This is the type of daily, day-in, day-out problems that our small business community has to deal with. And so when you tax away that undistributed income, you're depriving that company of the ability to grow. You're depriving that company of providing additional wage benefits or opportunities to their employees because you're taking that capital. As Chair Anderson, I commend you for the things you're doing. I've met Governor Brownback. I've talked with him about some of these issues, and yes, a lot of it is anecdotal and not unlike what John F. Kennedy did in terms of cutting taxes and reforming the system, knew that it would be a downturn initially, but what their goal was to make Kansas an inviting place to lure businesses like those in Minnesota to a more favorable climate. So if we truly are going to do something in terms of growing our jobs and economy, which the governor agrees that small business really is the engine and backbone in Minnesota, these companies were asked to step up to the plate and to balance a budget problem not created by fiscal policy, but more about economic conditions and the recession. And they did that. And now the reserve has been filled. the budget reserves and, or the budget surpluses are projected. And, you know, the commentary back when the tax was placed is that we're asking these fortunate people to step up to the plate and make these extra contributions. Well, guess what? We've kind of solved the problem for the time being. We don't need their money anymore. Let them continue to grow this economy and let them continue to grow jobs, and the benefits will be there. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We're going to wrap it up here for questions from members, unless there's others, with Chairman Marquardt, and then we'll have the author wrap it up as we do, and then we're going to call our day. Chair Marquardt, but before you make your comments here, I would like to thank you for your help on House File 244. That is a big deal for our friends working with the township, so I do appreciate that. If you could wrap it up, then we'll go to the author. Chair Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and members. I mean, this is a good discussion to have, but I want to bring you back to priorities. I mean, last week we heard a bill that would eliminate the estate tax, $306 million over the biennium. That would help 1,100 filers a year. That's a yearly benefit to those filers of about $140,000 per return. So now we have a bill, another $352 million over 2 years, that is going to help about 21,000 filers. The 6% of the most successful small businesses that we have, small and large businesses that we have. And if you divide that out yearly, that's about $8,500 of tax benefit per return for 22,000 people. And yet you've got a tax incidence study that shows that our middle income, I'm going to use the fourth through the seventh decile according to the incidence report, is still paying, after everything that's been done the last 2 years, still paying about 11% more of their income in state and local taxes than the top 1%. I mean, why we would be prioritizing today a bill that provides about an $8,500 cut for 22,000 people when you still have the middle class paying a higher burden of a tax on their income. And just to put this in perspective a little bit, we've got a very popular provision that was in the tax bill, I think will hopefully be in the tax bill again this year, that would provide a 40% ag credit for school building bonds. It's about $40 million a year. Farms have lost 80% of their income since 2013. They're down 80% of their farm income. And yet, we're going to, and if you take the 75,000 farmers, let's say we average that $40 million out to 75,000 farms, that's about $533 of tax benefit per farm. And yet, and they've been suffering business-wise, and yet we've got a bill here that we're hearing that would provide over $8,000 of tax benefit to the most successful ones who have been doing pretty well. So, I mean, I don't think it's fair that you give $16 of tax relief for those making over $500,000 to only $1 for a farmer. 16 to 1. That's not right. And if you took the two bills we've heard, the McDonald bill and the Representative Anderson bill, $660 million, $650 per year, it's $330 million. You know, we're going to see over $700 million of property tax increases now in the last 2 years. You could take $300 million and fully exempt all of ag property taxes on school bonds. That's $100 million. You could exempt the first $150,000 on businesses. That's probably another $75,000. You could reinstate LGA county program aid back to 2003 certified levels. You could add renter's credit, homestead credit, and really dig into the property tax thing and still have money to spend with that $330 million. So it's a matter of priorities to me. I mean, we can discuss this, and I think everyone makes good points. But I think, and I've said this before, we need a strategic, targeted tax relief plan that are going to impact the people who need it the most. Our senior citizens, our working families, our veterans, our farmers, our students, our small business owners, that's what we really have to do. So I'm hearing some of these bills that are coming through, and it sounds like that's some pretty high priorities. Those are not the priorities I hold, and I'd rather see relief go to farmers and seniors and some of these folks who need it first before we give huge tax relief to those who have seen the most success in recent times. And one last thing, if I might, because I hear a lot. if you don't have a chance, take a look at Ernst & Young. Every year they produce a report, and they work with the Council of State Taxation, and that's an advisor group to the state chambers of commerce. So it's a pretty credible group. And every year they look at an effective business tax rate in comparison to basically the state's gross domestic product. So it's kind of a comparison. And in the last one that came out December of 16, which I think would be 2015, we are 25th. So I mean, I hear a lot about how we're out of alignment. And we're 25th, we're right in the middle of the pack. If you look at taxes per employee, we're 22nd from highest to lowest. So we're kind of in the middle of the pack. But another one, where if you look at the business share of total state and local taxes in Minnesota, according to this report, we're 44th towards the bottom, which is good. So can we always make taxes lower for businesses? Yes. But to say we're out of alignment, and I could cite the groups that say we do very well in indexes and so forth and as far as business. So it comes more than to just tax rates. But thank you for that. But, I mean, again, it comes down to priorities, and I think we can spend our dollars much better and help a lot more people in a different fashion.
And thank you, Mr. Marquardt. And I do apologize to you in the committee in the past. One thing as chair that I do not do on any of these bills is look at the fiscal note or the revenue notice. Why? Because you look at the ones we've been having, which, of course, I haven't looked at, but you look at those, and we are way over. So at this point, I want ideas. We're not crunching the numbers right now. I want ideas, and I want to listen to all ideas. And so, yes, I should have mentioned this earlier. In an earlier committee that we're not, we have to look at them and we have them, but I want to listen to ideas and not crunch the numbers, because if that was the case, according to the governor's proposal yesterday, we couldn't even do this one bill. You know, so it is about priorities, and you will be involved, as other members will be, when we put this here. We're going to hear a lot of ideas, and I'd also say the reason we're hearing these bills is because, of course, they're fine pieces of legislation, but we don't have any bills here. You know, so if you have some ideas, I mean, we got some, and we'll hear them, but I'd love to entertain ideas from both sides of the aisle to have these bills. Now, we didn't hear this bill just because we don't have any bills, because we do have some bills, and that this is an idea that Chair Anderson has worked very hard on, and so we're listening to it, but please, members, don't. You know, if we're going to go down the road, the way of the estate tax is $1 billion. We don't have $1 billion. I know that. But I want to hear ideas. We will make our priorities. We will put a bill together, and it's going to be just a fantastic bill. It really is. It's going to be huge. It's going to be an awesome bill. I just know it. So with that, if you could please wrap it up, Chair Daskowski, very briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, I think there were some good points raised here, Mr. Chair, and I hope that we as a committee and as a body don't set our sights short. There are, it's been evidenced here today in Representative Anderson's bill, Representative McDonald's bill, and others, and there are other good ones coming forward too. And Representative Marquardt raises good points. There's a variety of places in the farm community. There's our other property tax relief pieces we have. We need to set our sights high, Mr. Chair, and I would hope all of us join together in looking at a bill that doesn't look at $88 million of tax cuts or $1.4 billion of tax cuts. We should set our sights to $3 to $4 billion in tax cuts to help everybody in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That would be huge. Chair Anderson, to wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Draskowski. Representative Hertas, Representative Petersburg, you guys all raised some excellent points for us. I'm not trying to do anything that's different from what Governor Dayton is doing. The governor has spent $1.8 million on the Brooklyn Park Baxter Healthcare Group. He has put forward he's had a tax incentive plan for the Mayo Clinic, all with the motivation to grow jobs here in the state of Minnesota. So this is what this bill is about. It's about growing jobs here in the state. And it's no different than what Governor Dayton, he himself, is advocating for our state. So I'm glad that we are on the same page about the importance of having job growth and what that means, not to just those individuals that own that company, but the people that work for them. And I just want you to remember this statistic. Out of the entire state of Minnesota, 56% of the private workforce is from these small businesses. So when you say that this bill is only going to benefit those people that qualify for this tax break, you're wrong. It is 56% of the private workforce that benefits from having those jobs here in the state of Minnesota. And we had earlier today, Mr. Wise spoke about the fellow that used to be out housed right in Brooklyn Park. And where is he now? Iowa. He's in Iowa. And I remember in the 2013 bill where we had people lined out the door saying that this is a reality, my business is going to move somewhere else. And the one that touched me the most was a woman who was probably about 55 years old. She had worked for the company for 30 years that she had worked for the company. 30 years. And the company said, we can't keep it here anymore because the taxes are too high in the state. Can you imagine being that age, having to uproot your family and move to another state just to keep your job? Because that's the job that you had worked in for 30 years of your life? We're talking about keeping these jobs here in Minnesota, keeping the growth, making Minnesota the shining state that it has been in the past, and making sure that we have good paying jobs for our kids when they graduate from college, and that they can raise their families here just like we are right now. So I'd ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson S. Chair Anderson S. moves that House File 320 be laid over for possible inclusion in omnibus tax bill. Thank you for the spirited discussion. I thought it was great today. There are some that believe in equality of opportunity. Others believe in equality of results. Somebody said that. Somebody famous at one time. And so that's kind of what we have here. Okay, so with that, thank you, members, for your work today. Good government all the time. You're adjourned.